Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and video show which brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, and experience from hundreds of role models from around the world. If you're new to the channel, please subscribe so you won't miss a new episode. I'm your host, Fritz Bissemaker, and today I'm delighted and privileged to have a conversation with Glenn Ford. Glenn, welcome to the program.
Ah, thanks, Fritz.
Glenn, let me take the audience through your background. Reading up on your background, you have a background in tarmac, in building roads, in working with a car dealership. But at a certain moment in time, you became the managing director of the Aegis Trust. The Aegis Trust, for those people who don't know, the Aegis Trust is a UK-based organization which focuses on genocide prevention, education, and survivor support. So that's quite a career change on the outside. So again, welcome to the program. And so take the audience along. So welcome, take the audience along. How does someone who has, I would say, an average normal career all of a sudden decide, I'm going off on a tangent, I'm going to do something completely different with my life?
Well, thank you, Fritz. And in terms of the current day, so as you mentioned, I'm supporting and with and a friend of the Aegis Trust, an organization, and the founders I've been privileged to know for, I guess, best part of 40 years. And it was around 20 years ago this year when I found myself in Rwanda as a volunteer to help build the Kigali Genocide Memorial. And in the 4 weeks that I was there as a volunteer, using my annual leave, and my employer at the time granted me some additional leave in terms of paid leave, I found myself learning more about myself and more about humanity than I had done in, you know, whatever period I'd been alive up until that point. I was working alongside genocide survivors and others helping to create the memorial. And that experience had a profound effect upon me.
Okay.
At the point in my career, I was, you know, I've been in a corporate career for some 20 years, and there was an opportunity to get involved in Aegis. That was in a volunteer capacity, and I just thought that was I guess, an opportunity of a lifetime to be involved in something that had the potential to, well, in short, to change the course of history.
Okay. Actually, something happened before that I want to touch upon is when most people go on a holiday, they go off to an island, sit in the sun, do some kind of adventure, vacation, whatever. You decided to spend your holiday helping to build this genocide memorial. So was that the first time you got involved in that such an activity, or is that something you've always been doing?
It was the first time, really. As I've mentioned, I've been privileged to know the founders for 20 years prior then. So I was aware of what they were doing. They had created and set up the first Holocaust Education Centre in the UK, and it's still the only such centre in the UK. And this was not a family of particular sort of financial means, but somehow between themselves and friends and volunteers, they'd been able to establish a small centre in a former farmhouse.
Okay, so the fact that you went to Rwanda, was that do you know what your motivation was at the time? Was it curiosity, boredom, want to do something new? What was the trigger?
Yeah, with the trigger was I guess two things. So first of all, I'd known these people, the Smith family of the UK, and as I say, I'd known them for a long time. And you know, sometimes you meet people in life and you just think these are really good people, and within reasonable means, you're happy to do whatever you can to support what they're doing. So that was the first thing. The second thing was that I was aware that they were involved in Rwanda, and in early January 2004, I then attended a briefing in the UK talking about the memorial that was to be created. And this was a, you know, relatively speaking, a significant thing. It was a $2 million construction project, kind of the other side of the world, and it needed to be completed within the next 3 months. And I just thought that was a huge task for what was a, you know, a small family and friends and volunteers. And so it was just obvious that some help, I'm sure, would be appreciated. So I rang them. They were in Rwanda at the time and said, you know, can I help? And they basically said, look, you know, Glenn, if you can come out here as soon as you can, that would be very much appreciated.
Okay. What did your family say when they realized what you were out to do?
Well, I mean, so fortunately for me, my wife has also known the family that has been doing this for some time. So to a certain extent, well, to a large extent, there was a family connection. So it wasn't just me going off, you know, coming back to my family and suggesting something, you know, seemingly completely random. But even then, you know, it was a significant thing, but they were very supportive.
Okay. Now, and good to hear. Now, can you take the listener along? Maybe what happened in Rwanda, and after the fact, how they are going about trying to repair and recover the country?
Yes, of course. So the memorial was created. It was a, you know, remarkable achievement by all of those involved, and very much led by James and his brother Stephen Smith. And you know, I was privileged to be part of that. And then, really, once the memorial opened, it was then a case of two things: a, sustaining that activity, you know, from a financial and logistical aspect, but also then very much developing a program that would help to bring healing. And I say a program, a sort of a methodology, a means, and that would help to bring healing to that country, and very much work alongside Rwandans in that context.
Okay. Now, I had the honor to visit the Rwanda Memorial with you, and what surprised me in going through the memorial, it gave a history lesson of what happened, but also, in my perception, why it happened. So it did not just start with the civil war of the 90s, 30 years ago. I was surprised that history of Rwanda first being a German colony, then being a Belgian colony, was added to the narrative. Does this imply that background has impact and is part of where Rwanda got in the 90s? Or what's the reason why that history was taken into account?
Well, just to say, I mean, I think Rwanda in terms of 1994 was that, you know, to use that expression, was a perfect storm in all the wrong ways. So you had, you know, various things came together at the same time, but it was very much a trajectory that had started in the, well, really the 20s and the 30s in Europe. And we see this elsewhere, where you have a polarization of society, where people, you know, treat certain groups of people or identities of people as the other, and they start to develop a fear and even a hatred of those other people, even though they don't know the individuals. That then becomes, you know, potentially a recipe for disaster. That i.e., it's a thin end of the wedge. Okay. And in the context of Rwanda, what started off as a thin end of the wedge sort of just, if you like, took its full trajectory, and, you know, ended in the genocide that we saw in 1994.
Okay, before we go to the genocide and the aftermath itself, are you aware of any opposition when you put it in that historic context, as you just mentioned, when you said, okay, it's actually started in Europe in the 1920s and 30s. I can imagine that there might be individuals, organizations who say, look, this is a pure Rwandan issue, and you are bringing something in the equation which should not be there?
Well, two things I would say to that, and I'll just sort of refer back to my road building days in the quarrying industry, where, you know, safety is paramount, and anybody that's involved in an industry where safety is absolutely key, you know that the way that you avoid fatalities is by focusing on the near misses. You know, it's the same with health, isn't it? So the and it's the same with the with genocide or genocidal violence. If you want to prevent the cataclysmic outcome, you actually focus on the small kind of trigger points that maybe, you know, turn around and say, well, it's just a small amount of racism, it's just a small amount of polarization, you know, nobody's getting killed at the moment, don't worry about it too much. But we know it's a bit like the frog in the water. You know, the temperature is turned up slowly so the frog doesn't jump out. And that we saw that with the Holocaust, and we saw that with Rwanda, and we see that elsewhere. So that's sort of point one, is that trajectory. The second point is that it's always a danger when people say, oh, that's a faraway country. You know, we've heard that expression before. What's it got to do with us? That then basically becomes a green light to perpetrators that they can do whatever they wish because, you know, nobody cares.
Okay. Before we make conceptualize genocide and we have that discussion, the specifically the Rwanda one, was a predominantly cultural, racial, religious, political? What was the main distinction between the two groups which caused this to happen? Where's the mix of everything?
Yeah, and so just to say, I mean, it's something that we see elsewhere. So you get a convergence of ideology, and that ideology can either come from religious ideology, religious thinking, or it can come from, I guess, sort of other academic type thinking. And in terms of Rwanda, this came out of Europe of the 1920s, 30s, that basically some people were deemed to be more human than others. And that was, you know, I guess that came out of sort of Darwin and, you know, evolution and survival of the fittest and all of those. And that was mainstream in Europe in the 1920s and 30s. You know, you had the whole body of eugenics within the academic theory. You know, how do you deal with the growth of population, and also within the religious thinking at the time in terms of the Hermetic theory that, you know, some people are more human than others. So you had that sort of ideology thinking, but then also you had the convergence with politics, i.e. power, and the extremist, I guess, people in power in Rwanda in the 1960s. They exploited that.
Okay. Now, in a very relatively short period, almost 1 million people got massacred. It was global news. What can you take us through the aftermath, as it were? How did the how did Rwanda recover from this?
So in terms of the aftermath, I mean, just to say that the both the absolute and the relative extent of violence is just difficult to comprehend. You know, you've got 1 in 7 of the population, something, and 10,000 people per day, every day for 100 days. You know, someone kind of referred to this as like 9/11, you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner every single day for 100 days. I mean, it's just the level of violence was just cataclysmic, and its effect upon the community was very sudden. Whilst, you know, people were aware of tensions, but you went from, to a degree, normality to the next day, you know, you couldn't, I mean, it was just, you almost couldn't configure a horror movie as bad as this in terms of if you were living in that time. So I think that's the first thing, just to, and I think the nature of the violence and the, I guess, similar to the Holocaust, where it became very You know, people weren't doing this as crime. They were doing this as, you know, this is our work. This is sort of almost a Monday, a 9 to 5 type activity. So that's the first thing to say. I think the second thing is the recovery from that. And it is still recovering, understandably. You know, you don't go through that level of loss, and even 30 years just then become, you know, entirely normal. But I think the recovery since then is just simply astounding, and all credit to the Rwandan people, to the nation of Rwanda, in terms of that level of recovery.
Yeah, and because what obviously the main theme which really surprised, to some even extent shocked me, was the theme of forgiveness. That if you don't forgive, you'll remain a victim. And that also the perpetrators are become victims almost. Because I was so surprised when we had a presentation from the manager of the Rwanda Genocide Memorial, Freddie, who lost 80 members of his family, 80. A, I'm still surprised that this person is able to smile, but even more surprised that he was able to stand next to the perpetrator, the person who literally, you could say, murdered his parents. That so. What's the lesson learned there?
So you're correct, Fritz. And just to say, it is remarkable. And I don't know if it's the only place in the world where this extent of coming together has happened. I mean, I'm sure during the annals of history, it must have happened somewhere at some point. But at this scale, at a national level, it is remarkable. And I think my own observation, I think there's a few factors that kind of feed into that. First of all, the survivors didn't have any choice. They, you know, they continued to live where they were living, and their neighbors were their killers. I'm sure if you'd said to the survivors 20, 30 years ago, we're going to take all the perpetrators away and take them to somewhere out of the country, they would have been very happy about that. Alternatively, if someone had provided them with a land of milk and honey and said, you can come and live in this place, I'm sure they would have gone for that. And if we think back to the Holocaust, you know, the Jews, you know, in the vast majority could leave. They could go to America, Australia, they could go to Israel. Whereas in Rwanda, that simply wasn't an option. So there's an element of the first people you see when you wake up every day being your killers. And I think for the survivors, it was, you know, it was the better option. I say the better option was probably the only option in some respect, because, you know, many of them thought, well, just, you know, where does this end? And because the survivors were still very much in the minority, I think many of them kind of took the difficult path that it was, you know, to consider forgiveness was a better alternative than constantly living in hate. And, you know, what future did they give their children?
That takes a lot of courage and power and tenacity to achieve that as an individual and as a society, I guess. And are there any lessons? Because from the Aegis Trust, you provide aiming to provide genocide prevention and education. What are the lessons learned which could help to prevent or mitigate future genocides?
Well, I think the big lesson from Rwanda is it's possible to live together with people that you formerly hated for, you know, for maybe valid or invalid reasons, but people that, you know, today that you could not envisage being in the same room with. I think the big lesson from Rwanda is it's possible to overcome that hatred. I think that is the big, big lesson.
Okay. To what extent is that, you could say, a lesson for a survivor, or can this also be a lesson, for prevention?
Well, I think it's both really, because obviously for survivors, it gives a I mean, it's a challenge, isn't it? I mean, you know, we've all been through, you know, thankfully not to the extent of incurring that level of loss, but we've all incurred, well, we've either had things done against us or we've been a perpetrator in some way, you know, not necessarily I'm saying at that scale, but, you know, I guess that's part of humanity, isn't it? That, you know, we make mistakes and other people make mistakes and we carry the burden of that. But I think it is, so I think for survivors, well, I think for all of us, it gives us hope. About a future where we don't have to live alongside people and hate them or be hated.
Okay. Are you aware? I mean, that is, like I said, a very optimistic, idealistic picture how to treat such a situation. In reality, I can also imagine that there's still going to be individuals who are going to take a different route. What does that are you aware that that's happening? So there's still this is there still some kind of revenge? And if that's the case, how does it look like, and what's being done about that?
Sure. Well, look, I mean, I think that the big lesson from Rwanda is not just someone coming and saying, you know, I've forgiven these people, why can't you? And you just think, well, sure, but how?
Yeah.
I think the big hope from Rwanda is there are lots of details about how people did that. And I think obviously every case is unique, and even within Rwanda, I mean, it's not a, you know, Rwandans wouldn't say it's just, you know, entirely uniform and everybody is high fives. But having said that, it is a the country has moved on a huge distance, even from when I was there 20 years ago. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, you wouldn't even have mentioned the word forgiveness. You know, people just weren't even ready for that word, let alone the act. And so I think and even within the past 10 years, that has become much more mainstream. So I fully, you know, we all are human at the end of the day, and knowing what we should do and being able to do it are two different things. But I think the big lesson from Rwanda is there is a pathway there that people can learn from in terms of the details.
Okay. Now, I was wondering, you live in the UK, visit Rwanda on a regular basis. Why did they accept your help and your support to get this organized?
Well, it's a good question. And I think, again, all credit to the Rwandans, who just a few years after the genocide, that they were actively looking for help and assistance, both in terms of rebuilding the country, but also in terms of rebuilding the people, rebuilding the hearts and minds. And so the involvement of Aegis was in response to a request from the Rwandans, and this specifically at the time was the mayor of the city of of Kigali, and the minister of sports and culture, who in the late 90s, early 2000s, so this was just, you know, 6 or 7 years after the genocide, were seeking organizations and individuals who could help them in that journey of rebuilding and recovery.
Okay, and how are you aware why they accepted the Aegis Trust as an organization to help support that? Because I can also imagine that when you get a request like that, you can also abuse the request given the natural resources Rwanda has.
Well, and so that's a very good question. And I think, you know, when they, so I think they were visiting a number of memorials across the world. And my understanding is they went to South Africa, and some people in South Africa said, you need to visit these people in the UK. That wasn't me, but that was the family that had started this some 40 years ago. And so they visited this farmhouse in sort of Nottinghamshire in the UK, allegedly close to where Robin Hood used to hang out, nearby to Sherwood Forest. And it's a very modest property. It's in sort of 1 acre of land. And the Rwandans came, they visited there. I think this was in 2001. And what they found was, as I say, is a modest a property, but somewhere that was bringing comfort to survivors, in this instance, Holocaust survivors, but also it was educating children about the dangers of prejudice, British children. And they saw that this had been, you know, done by a family. And I think it was those two aspects that they were particularly attracted to. That A, this didn't have to be some big, huge, multi-million dollar memorial. It could be something on a modest budget.
Yeah.
But also the aspect of bringing comfort to survivors, but then developing an education program to really break that cycle of hatred. It was that I think they were very, very attracted to.
Okay. If you work and live in this space, as you just shared with us, how do you identify your success? What is success in this context?
So two things I would say, Fritz. So first of all, you know, the opportunity to, I guess, benefit people's lives is always a privilege. And we've all had instances where we have been the beneficiary of other people's actions, and we're incredibly grateful for people doing that. And so having the opportunity to do, I guess, that in reverse and to help and support others is always a privilege. And it's something that has been, I guess, part of who I am. And I'm clearly not the only person that would relate to that. I think secondly, in terms of success, is then the ability to scale this up into something that can really, as I said at the beginning, has the ability to change the course of history. You can teach children how to hate. We kind of know how to do that, sadly. But we can also teach children the opposite. We can teach them about values. We can teach them about humanity. And I think the real opportunity in Aegis, which is what I saw 20 years ago, is that education has to be different. It's not just about being able to add up, being able to read and write. There was something about values, common decency, common humanity, which can be taught and which can be spread, if you like, propagated. And I think that's the real kind of opportunity and success factor in Aegis in the future, is are we able to change the system?
Great. That's an ambitious goal, but a very noble goal. In the 20 years history you've been involved, to what extent has it been a bumpy ride? What kind of mistakes or failures have you come across, and how did you recover from that?
Sure. Well, look, I mean, I think anybody that's involved in this will say, you know, the road's always going to be bumpy. It's always going to be, to a degree, a meander. But I think just being, you know, focused on that clear goal and on that clear vision means that you always come back to that. I mean, I think in terms of the learning points, I think the key thing is being able to scale things up. You know, to save and to benefit individuals' lives is always something that is, you know, is heartening to do. But when you realize that you're not changing the system and you could benefit so many more lives, I think that's where you're just, I guess, mindful of the missed opportunity. And sometimes there is a trade-off between, you know, what you can do to save lives in the here and now, and maybe what you can do to change the system and in the future context, you know, save many, many more lives. And I think trying to find the fine line between those two things is always a challenge, really.
Okay. two more questions at the end, Glenn. Time is moving so fast. First of all, for those people who are not in the position to visit Rwanda, Kigali, and the memorial, what would your advice be? How can they educate themselves?
Well, I think so. Stories are just so very powerful, human stories. I think survivor stories, but also, stories of rescuers. It's very grounding. It's very enriching in our lives. And there's plenty of material available online, whether it be the Aegis Trust website or kind of other links and channels. I'll just encourage people to engage with those materials as best they can.
Okay, two more questions. Do you see yourself ever moving on beyond your involvement with Aegis?
So, I mean, I think Aegis is something within in the lifeblood, if you like, because it's about how we treat each other. It's how we treat ourselves, and so I think there's always, for me, there's always going to be that kind of connection. I can't envisage a point in which I'd say, well, that's no longer part of. It's almost like saying kindness is, I've kind of done with kindness now. I've been kind enough. Like, at what point do you say, I'm just going to be mean to people? I know you're not quite asking that question, but I think it's something that I'd always want to be involved with in some way, shape, or form, in terms of, what that means logistically, and how, I guess, that might be the case. It's I guess let's wait and see.
Okay, well, let's wait and see. Final question. What would your advice, what's your lesson to people, young and old, out there, based on your experience you want to pass on?
Sure. Well, I'll just go back to some words of and this is from the White Rose movement of the 1940s in Germany, Hans and Sophie Scholl, and these words always inspire me. Young, not quite teenagers, a little bit beyond that, but 20, 21, 22. And Sophie Scholl said, I think it was about 1942, 1943, how can righteousness prevail if nobody's willing to do a single righteous act? What will my life bring if it inspires others into action? It will have had meaning. And so I guess my comment is we can, humanity is not a spectator sport. We're all on the pitch, and we all make a difference through positively or negatively through our actions or inactions. And so I just my comment to everybody would be, each and every day we can do something or not do something to help to inspire others to take positive actions.
Len, I want to thank you so much. It's been an honor to talking to you about what you're doing in Rwanda with the Genocide Memorial and the lessons you just shared with us. Thank you so much.
That's great. You're most welcome, Fritz.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.